Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we're meriting to exist at this most existential moment with the intent and the intention of being connected to Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You now tune into Blog Talk Radio, and we humbly assert with a higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class program presentation 715. Conversation with Jerome Sage Butler, Part 3. Blesses our Creator, Baruch Hashem, Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the entire human family experience. More than 7.5 billion human beings streaming and gleaming upon this blessed earth. This is Anti-Eugenics Radio. With Creator's help, our broadcast is taking place right now on December 23rd, starting at 11:30 a.m. It's now 11:32 a.m. Jamaica time from the Diamond of the Caribbean, corresponding to 12:32 live from Turtle Island, equals the USA, equals AKA Unified Soul Actualization. We plan on speaking with co-host Tria Life. I'm sorry, not Tria Life. Yes, Tria Life, co-host. Let me just start all over again. I didn't drink enough coffee this morning. We plan on speaking with co-host Tria Life, television network prolific lecturer, Jerome Sage Butler, who dwells within his spiritual, cognitive, emotional realm, coined promoting Tree of Life values. Butler is driven to tap into his deep ancestral wellsprings of divine source, correlating, relating, and developing a dialogue with other human souls intended to guide human dialogue towards analyzing the moral and ethical nature we as human beings are well advised to explore. Program content will focus on a continuing series on empowering women in order to strengthen men. Or man. And please check out one of Jerome Sage's latest video clips, which you can go to YouTube by typing in Jerome Sage Butler and then Tree of Life. You can also learn more about Butler by friending him on Facebook and typing in Tree of Life Network, again on YouTube Network. And as well, we will speak at the end of the program how you can partner with our efforts, because let's say we've been doing this now for 8.5 years, and it does cost money. We would like to help others help us, and then we can help others, empower them with an awakening of the divine image within each and every one of us. If we help someone, say, as we've been broadcasting now into 43 states in the United States of America and over 45 countries around the world, going behind the mind, penetrating it with teachings that are pleasant and peaceful, nothing lewd about our conversation, blessed souls, and to offer his first verbal libation for today's program, Jerome Sage, live from, I believe, the St. Andrews District of Jamaica. Good morning, Jerome Sage.
Blessed good morning, Baba Dan. Much love and salutation in the various seasons, you know, of our celebrations. Blessings to all our listeners, all the people who tune in, both live and archived, you know, all over the United States of America, in Jamaica and the Caribbean, and also all over Africa, you know, Asia,
yes,
even to Russia, you know. We do give thanks, Brother Dan, you know, it has been an interesting, you know, couple of programs on empowering the female consciousness, empowering the ladies to empower the man, because when we started out, I was in a totally traumatic situation, and in time it has transformed from a traumatic situation to being more in harmony with the late Saru. So I'm thankful that, you know, the spirit does, you know, connect with the external, you know, and it's good. I can see in my life evidence that, you know, the return of that nurturing is on in earnest. So blessings and love and love and love.
Amen. Before we go further, Drumstitch, and blessed souls around the world, I want to dedicate today's humble efforts, as I like to call them, our verbal libations, in the merit of the elevation of the soul of my dear mother-in-law, Rivka Fortuna Alei Shalom, may she rest in peace, Bas Daniel, may he rest in peace, and also for a young man who was taken too quickly from this world, Eliyahu Ben Menachem Mendel Shemikom Domo, who was taken at the tender age of 24 in Rogers Park in Chicago, and also one of the people I've been working with for the past 10 years. She also left us too soon. Her name is Shane Daliba. Aleha Shalom, may she rest in peace. Bas Harav Tzvi Mordechai, Aleha Shalom. Just to point out, Drum Sage, and for people around the world listening, I first of all want to thank our listeners out in Ghana. Drum Sage, they've been consistently listening in. 12.6% of our listeners are coming from the Western state. The Western state of Africa. And we're getting, unfortunately, Nigeria dipped below 1%. We're getting about 1.26% from Morocco, from Namibia, 1.14%, from South Africa, 2%, and Kenya is 1.13%. We get about almost 77% from America, 10.4% from Chile. We also have Cuba listening in. We have Jamaica, Bermuda, the Bahamas, Germany at 3%. So we have a very eclectic audience, and also is all of Mexico and every country in South America except for that little stubborn country, Guyana. I don't know why Guyana is not turning on, but hopefully, again, we'll get beyond those closed doors. And I just want to start, Rome Session, I hope you'll embellish this teaching, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1979 had an audience with a individual, an Israeli, who was involved in the radio business. It was called Kol Yisrael, literally the voice of Israel. And the Rebbe went on to address the medium of radio specifically. He mentioned that radio waves penetrate closed doors in places that are normally hard to reach. Radio waves are part of the Most High's creation. And the Rebbe explained, according to the oral Torah tradition of Israel, who taught that everything in creation was meant to used for spreading godliness in the world, anything new that we discover, such as radio waves, should be used for holiness. The Rebbe added that those who work in radio must be extra careful, and we must never hurt others through this medium of insulting or slandering people, or even by just speaking badly of others. We must watch carefully what comes out of our mouths and keep our language clean of crude or obscene words. So I'm taking that message to heart, Drum Sage, and please, if you can embellish on the Rebbe's words to those people behind the closed doors of their heart. How can we penetrate and open up those doors to understand that radio waves are a created entity which are used by human beings now in the last, I guess, 100-plus years to hopefully, in the positive sense, open up the hearts of others towards a life of kindness, goodness, and proper human stewardship upon the face of this blessed earth?
I think the Rebbe definitely was onto something quite profound and beautiful, yet simple and, you know, naturally human, and also godly as well, too. I mean, the beauty of it is that even with the design of modern societies and the design tending for the last maybe couple of hundred years to lead to this kind of overall external control of our lives, but the Rebbe is pointing to the fact that within all of that, there is this unity in society, and if we create these instruments of, I would say, socialization, whether through religion or even through the whole structure of politics. The essence of it is when you have the voice or the hearing of the people, right? You've organized people in what we call societies, nation states. And so we've got these organized groupings and the head of these entities having this vast power. Radio came up, I mean, let me, because I can't speak on it. And not speak to some of the issues that was the creation of radio, because it was first brought across, certainly for us in the Caribbean, in the World Service, right, in 1932, in England, right? And so we learned about international radio broadcasting and so forth. And then they began a whole move towards, using radio waves to kind of transmit an instant message, right? Sort of like the telegraphy was doing before, but except now a voice message, right? So immediately now you could speak to masses of people. The first thing I had considered when I thought about radio, because I always loved radio, I recognized that, well, a good message is one thing. To have something good to say. You know, some of my parents would say, if you don't have anything good to say, they don't say anything, right? So the first thing I said, well, it is almost for the good news. Now, I'm sure there's a sharing of a certain important news to the people, or the governance of people. So there's always politics, and there's always going to be something about entertainment. But the religious, you know, the essence of the soul, something spiritual, that's one of the fundamental things that should be brought across the medium of radio, of the application of this quality thought across the radio waves, because one would say it has mainly been used to program people, to project a certain kind of a specific centralized thinking. But if we now, in this modern age, have now the access to what we call independent radio, right, where we're not necessarily run by these big organizations or these already organized groupings, right? So when we touch the airwaves, we don't have to speak, let's say, the politically correct truth, but the actual truth. Respect and mannerisms already imbued, because the essence of, you know, coming across so many people, as I said, you begin to recognize there are many cultures, you know, many different viewpoints. So you can't be forceful, you know. And if you come to Rastafari like I have, Rastafari says we have a moral persuasion, not a moral, you know, it's not a force, you know. So it's a matter of almost diplomacy. So, you know, it should be gentle and, you know, simple. It's not like you're trying to convert souls, but showing people a way of life that have informed a better living in you. And if the evidence of that better living is obvious, then the radio waves and the essence of the information you're transmitting is worthy. It is valuable. You know, and I value the fact that there are people listening on the other end, and that there are conversations generated towards bringing value. So I agree with Rebbe that it's one of God's gifts, you know. And I think this is one of the gifts that we should take very much good care of, and realize that it's something that links us and unifies us if we are willing to connect to our voice and our hearing.
Beautiful. I agree. And I want to chime in what you just said before about not converting or proselytizing. When I was in my primordial stage, before I embraced for the first time with a full-time 24/7 commitment to my national roots and my faith roots, that it was precisely in the gentle hands of the friends that I bonded with and their families in Paterson, New Jersey, Jamaican families, Rastafarians, who never tried to recruit me to become a Rasta, but rather talked about, emphasized the idea of roots and world sound as power. And they never even told me to go back to my roots. They just said, listen, this is the meditation was sharing with you, but it percolated with my mind that if they're proud to who they are, then I have to be, and I mean in a humble way. There's a pride which comes with humility, and then there's a pride which can lead to false self-esteem, which can lead to projecting a lot of negativities on other people who are not of their quote-unquote group or nation or culture or faith base or religion, whatever you want to call it. So the Rasta community does have a moral imperative and power to encourage each one. And I just want to mention one more thing, and before we get into the feminine mindset, Jerome Sage, is that There's a Rav Yitzhak Ginsburg who spoke from a live internet showing a couple weeks in Barcelona, Spain. He said there is a yearning now with more and more peoples to go back to their ancestral roots to see where they are coming from. So in many ways, I'm sure thousands, it could be millions, it could be hundreds of millions of people that the Rastafarian community, through the inspiration of King Selassie, have inspired consciously and subconsciously to look a little bit more in and to break through those closed doors. Any comments on that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Brother Dan. Like I was saying that, you know, growing up in Jamaica, and, you know, when you find yourself coming to a level of awareness and seeing the kind of lifestyle and understanding the lifestyle of the Rastaman, because at first it is not necessarily as loved or as beratedly in terms of praise as maybe the Christian lifestyle is in Jamaica, right? The structural, traditional Christian lifestyle. So it took some experience to understand the Rastafari way. But then after getting that experience, I begin to realize that, well, one of the most important things they always speak about, because I remember when I was like about like 17, I had an encounter with a Rastaman. And I was basically reading a lot of, you know, Chinese, Japanese, and Asian culture, because it was something that was natural in me from the child. I also wanted, you know, there's this calling to, you know, connect and information. So he was saying, well, when do you spend time reading the African information? And I said, well, actually, I spent a lot of time reading the European information, right? And this is now I'm reading the Asian information. And I said, well, I plan to read the Indian information because that's sort of the family as well. And I plan in time to get around to the African. And he's like, well, I think you should get around to the African. No. Because I think, you know, part of one's identity should come first. And that is where you should start, where you are. And it's just that would obviously be one way to learn about the world. It's not through someone else's eyes, but through your own eyes, right? Through the eyes of your people. So, I mean, I was 15, so it was a lot to handle, because I knew what he meant, right? So we had a run-in a while, maybe like a year after, and he noticed I had a different book in my collection reading. And he's like, whoa, that was very good, because it seems like you really did make a little shift, because now you have three of those books, but you have one book about, you know, Black and African culture. So there's something about the true self, and I don't think, you know, a person's identity should be left out of the process of awakening. When you have awoken, your identity shouldn't skewer the truth also. So I don't believe that race-based consciousness or race-based awakening is complete awakening. So I just want to say that. And when I say certain things, I'm not trying to backtrack from being Black conscious or Black aware, because when you speak this way, sometimes the Black conscious folks amongst my own race grouping will feel like you're saying stuff like you're trying to move away. No, I'm not trying to create a one-color scheme. I'm saying that when you become awoken based upon your race-based consciousness, you realize that there's truth beyond color. And then firmly standing in your color is recognizing that if I speak with a certain language, right, I still will speak the truth. So what does it matter, my language? My language matters to me, you know. But when it comes to others, the engagement of truth is what's most important. So the Rastafari and the culture I grew up in talked about the importance of embracing the truth. We're human, so we have flaws in such perceptions, but as best we could, that's what we grew in. That's how we grew. So respect for the women is like something that was stronger in the Rastafari tenets of religious identity, or spiritual identity, I should say, than it was in Christianity. Because in Christianity, they have a kind of a view of women, which is not necessarily like the sinner of the world who brought shame, right, based upon the Eve tradition. So the Rastafari was saying, no, the woman is a queen, she's a goddess, and then she needs to be placed, you know, right beside a king. Now, again, I say that not every Rastaman, within the context of, you know, the religious or the spiritual identity, were so pious as to be really treating his woman equally. But then that was just a matter of the individual minds as well, because men were equal with their women without philosophy. So you find that what I got to understand is that the more educated people became in a European way of thinking, this Christian view, the European Christian view, they were very disrespectful to women. And so I grew up under that culture, right? But at the same time, you know, though they have grown up under that culture, women were supposed to be their carers, and they were supposed to be the material protectors and burden bearers in terms of the, we call it the breadwinner. That's what they gave us those philosophies from, right? Now, when I hear people reason with such views of life, sometimes it's very difficult to think that people can reason outside such context and still respect women, because they think that is the only way to respect each other. So we've been given this religious view of women, which is not very good. And I'm saying that not to offend no one, but just to be honest, that's how I see it, right? So we're given this view of women that weren't really that good at all, except that she was to be a good servant, right? So therefore, you couldn't tell a man growing up in that his women weren't supposed to be subservient to him, and that he wasn't supposed to embody this incredible ruler who was supposed to have all the power. So that unbalanced structure made him puffed up and egotistical, and hence a lot of times unresponsive emotionally. Now, we can go into why men should be emotional, and we can get into the fear of sexuality and whatever, and that's not my game. My issue is to say this, that something has happened because of our religious socialization to cause us to look at women a certain way, and hence look at ourselves as man a certain way. And both of those views, from the woman and the man's side, ain't healthy. It ain't healthy for us. Rastafari began to show a way for me to look at myself and for us who were engaged in the understanding of their culture, whether we want to or not, that the women were queens and goddesses and that the perception was equal. And that was very important because I think when you grew up children with that view now, I thought the deficiency in expectations would equalize, you know? That men would stop look at women as sex factories and women would stop look at men as these kind of monetary gratification. Because these are stereotypical roles we are given, but it plays out more in black communities, impoverished communities, right? So I begin to recognize that, one, if I think a certain way about my reality and I was going to try to find a mate, and she wasn't automatically thinking the same way about the reality. No, I know that a black man and black woman can agree with that. If I could hear them say amen right now, they would say amen. Because the truth is that you look at yourself a certain way. You're educated within the system and you're beginning to understand things. You're not trying to toot your horn and say you're so great or you know everything. But then when you begin to say, okay, let me go find my mate then, you realize that, ladies, you can say this more than I can. It's almost like you got to make that man. Isn't that true? Isn't that true, ladies? That it's almost like you have to make that man because you can't see him exist. But in your mind, you know, because of your education, because of your experience of life, think there should be such a man to be your mate. Man, I know it's the same for you. When we look in our mind to see that woman and say, yeah, because we know ourselves to be this way as a man, and we say, okay, we can see how we are supposed to evolve into true being. It's like you can't find that woman who's automatically thinking the same. You got to delve into realities to almost make her too, to go find her, construct her from out of the myriad perceptions, almost like a shifting vortex of possibilities going around, and they're placated on every angle except the one that you are stirring in self-image of black man, black woman, or a lot of poorer men and poorer women across the global scale, regardless of color, right? And it goes right across to even the educated and highly powerful, that there's already an imbalance in the perceptions. But for us, especially how I grew up, it's hard. It was very hard. So now as I began to mature, I realized I have to, in the woman, whoever she is, that I would call wife, queen, princess, there has to be some nurture. Some people might not like the argument. Some people might think it's a wordplay. And I think so sometimes it might seem that way too, because I'm not an idiot. You know, I don't look from my angle only, I look from the other's angle. Because some people say, the realness of life is every day I got to get up and earn. And sometimes this one beside me, she don't seem to understand that. And we got to be like this every day. So when a man is talking, our fancy talk, a man is saying, what is he talking about? So I get that. But I'm saying that what I learned from all of my experiences is that really and truly, it's like you have to nurture that spirit of whatever you want for your life,
yes,
in her
yes.
life. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. If you don't nurture that, it's not going to happen, because it's not like the women automatically have a click understanding, oh, this is what he wants and this is how to do it. No, we're all mis-socialized. So I think this re-socialization or an attempt at it is healthy for us, man, and for the woman as well, too.
Amen. I'd like to chime in to acknowledge the part of three women just from the opening chapters of the book of Exodus who actually involved in saving the life of baby Moses and later adult Moses. Number one, after the decree that Pharaoh had commanded, this is in chapter 1, verse 22, that Pharaoh commanded that every boy that is born cast into the river Nile and every girl you shall keep alive, that Moses' oldest sister, his oldest sibling, Miriam, followed his little ark, so to speak, that was placed on the Nile River, and to make sure that there would be a good outcome. Now, who would be the receiver of that little ark bearing baby Moses? The daughter of Pharaoh himself, and eventually she herself would be integrated into the nation of Israel and actually would marry one of the princes from Judah. She's called in Hebrew Bat Paro, the daughter of Paro. But after she became an Israelite, she became Batya, the daughter of the Most High. So that's woman number two. Woman number three would actually be Moses' wife, the Isha Kushit, the Cushite is an expression for Ethiopian. When they were going back after the Most High gave Moses the command to return to Egypt to be the first redeemer of Israel, that if you go to chapter 2, and I'm just turning the pages just to make sure we have the right pages here, that he was actually attacked by an angel. And this is right here in the scripture here, that he was attacked by an angel for not carrying out the circumcision of one of his children. And she actually realized through her additional understanding, as in the female gender, actually carried out the circumcision, and the angel let go of Moses, and then he eventually would go on to Egypt. So we see here, right in the first pages of this of the book of Exodus, circumcision, anyone listening out there, we see three women having a primary playing a primary factor in saving the mighty Levite prophet. And not only that Miriam actually had rebuked her father Amram, who had actually divorced his wife after the decree was made by Pharaoh to throw the boys into the Nile and just let the girls live. And she said, "Father, you're worse than Paro. Paro will kill only the boys by you separating from mother." And he was the leader. The Levites were not enslaved. It was the other 11 tribes that were enslaved. That she said, a five-year-old girl told her father a prophetic spirit, if you keep divorced from mother, then other members of our people will divorce their wives, and therefore what will become of our nation will only produce girls, and then they will survive. So you're going to participate by not being married, by not being fulfilling the command, being fruitful and multiply. I just want to throw into the mix before we get into some of the teachings of King Solomon's circumcision, because I think people get the impression, as you mentioned, I can't speak for the Christian perspective because I'm a Jew, I'm not a Christian, that even within the Jewish faith, that many people have a archaic look because of lack of knowledge, and that's why this dialogue has to come out. And I was thinking about this for a couple of days before the problem came on. When I walk around my social service agency, it is run by predominantly women, who actually most of them at the level that I'm at in middle management are actually at my level and way above me. So there are more people in middle and higher management in my agency. These are women who work, have families, or now are grandmothers, some of them even great grandmothers. So I see in the sense of just living reality that these women don't feel that they are just, you know, cooking the bread and the meat stew in the kitchen and sweeping the floor. They're living their lives, and they're in partnership with their husbands. And as I also consider that with my own wife of valor.
Absolutely, that is a true way, you know, because people say that maybe the whole archaic viewpoints of the whole family structure, lots of religious men might say, our spiritual minded men would say that the woman's role has changed and has done so to emasculate men. But one of the most important reasons why the women have roles in responsibility is because, number one, there's been for some time a lack of basic coherency in parenting from the fathers, especially their presence. And this goes across all races too, right? Because I think a lot of, I think there's a differential between our race and a lot of the races that are in the first world countries, is that they have money, the access to a monetary system economically that's more functional. So let's just say the state designs a system where there's child support, right? So automatically a delinquent father in the first world countries would automatically have to take care of the financing of his children based upon a state decree. You know, there is something within the legal systems would say this is how much you pay child support or whatever. So there's this quasi-responsibility. The point I'm getting to is this. Now, because there's this quasi-responsibility that, you know, there is this material transfer from the father and it seems that he's being responsible, a lot of times what is missing is that his social presence. His presence as a father and a husband is missing from the socialization of his children. It's so easy to blame the rest of the world for everything that's wrong, but it's so hard for a man or a woman to look at themselves and look at the family that they have and realize that you don't really have a husband in the home as a wife. And as a husband, you don't really have a wife in the home. And because you are unbalanced, any attempt you think you can truly use to discipline children is going to fail, because all is going to happen, the word discipline comes from the fact that you are not creating a life that was harmonious in the first place. That's why they're in discipline. The need for discipline isn't created because we are disciplined. It's created because we are in discipline, meaning that the parents failed in socializing children in how to be respectful of both males and females. And we're not talking about gender-based roles again. We're talking about respecting of yourself. That's what I'm learning from Rastafari. Sorry for the potlight here. That is what I learned. That's what I have learned from Rastafari. So you have to respect. Mm-hmm. If you don't put that around you as a family, if a king man, as always said in Rastafari, if a king man don't take care of the queen, right, make a structure around the family where him, young prince and the young princess, son and daughter, can look at the king and the queen and feel like this is how we are to be. One, there's an image of a mother and a wife. Two, there's an image of a father and a husband. That is something you don't have to go read in sociology books, right? You don't have to go read it in those because you would have had it at home. So it is something very essential for males and females to understand that you are really in control of several generations by just how we are as man and woman. Nurturing each other, really looking out for each other. And it doesn't just mean being respectful to each other in terms of wordplay. It means in terms of a life, building a life together where the environment is exactly that. So when you lay back as a king, you feel like kingliness. And when she lays back as a queen, she feels like queenliness. Or you put it another way, when I sit back as Jerome, I want her to sit back as herself. And knowing that all that we have constructed and created, we have. Like I did it, you know, like I'm going, hey, look what I have done, this is my wife too. No, look what we have created, and this is my family.
Beautiful. Jerome, it's now we've entered the second half of the program. We do have a caller. I like to bring him or her, and I'm not exactly sure this will be, but caller, when I let you in, if you can just give your first name and where you're calling from, that'd be wonderful. So caller, welcome to the program. Thank you for calling in. What is your first name, please, and where are you calling from?
How are you? This is Williams.
Williams, good afternoon.
You,
good afternoon. I see that, and first of all, Williams, I want to thank you for your great patience, because I had spoken to Jerome Sage previously that we wanted to try to get a half hour, and now we've got, actually, in potential, depending on Jerome Sage's time, I have up to another 58 minutes, but we'll see how it goes. Any take on the matters that we've discussed up until this point?
Definitely think that everything you mentioned, Jerome mentioned, is very valid, and that it is something that that right now in society we have things seem to be have a disconnect. Because I know that as far as me growing up, I've always been told that you have to that men are the providers and women are ones that should be the take care of the household. But as I grow up and grow more spiritually, I see that it does create a superiority and an inferiority complex. But in the idea of the yin and yang, or the imbalance, both of us, we both have to be able to help each other.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I want to mention I think I've mentioned the last program, so I got to talk a little about my personal history. I was fortunate that, you know, my parents, they were married for almost 57 years, and my mother was actually the first woman in her family, being a second generation Jewish American woman. Her parents coming from, her father coming directly from, was it Belarus, White Russia, and I'm not exactly sure where her mother came from. They met in a sewing factory in Manhattan. They married, and my mother came along. She was the first to get a college education. She married my father, and she worked from 1959 up until about 1962, and then I was born in 62, and she made the decision that based on his salary that she would raise me, and then 5 years later my brother would come along. And then eventually in 1976, I believe, she went back into the workforce when my brother was about 9 or 10 years old, because she felt at that point she could actually, I think he was, no, about 1980. Let me put that, 1980, when he was about 14 or 15. And I just want to mention one thing. My father was 6 foot tall. May he rest in peace. My mother's only 5 foot tall, so that was an interesting combination unto itself. And I don't remember this, but my mother once told me that one time my father gave me a strong hit, I guess, to discipline me. And my mother said to him, all 5 foot of her, said, if you ever hit my son again, I'm going to divorce you. And my father never touched me again. So here we see feminine David stood up to masculine Goliath, and Goliath backed down without her having to throw a rock into his head. So these scenarios have existed, can exist, where the women can assert themselves, and all of a sudden, you know, even in the jungle, I mean, from the nature videos I watched, the lioness is basically more of the predator than the king lion.
She's the hunter. She's the hunter. And, you know, in the weirdest sense, you know, if you mention this to a lot of, because, you know, Rastafarians, I'm not picking on Rastafarians because it's my heritage, but a lot of Rastafarians do not like this part of this analogy, that the lioness does do a lot of the hunting, and the lions, the male lions, really, a lot of times are the ones that come like the arbiters of the dividing of the spoils, really. You understand? It's that the woman earns, and the man decides how is it appropriation, how it's appropriated, you understand, how it's apportioned. You see him come and he takes the lion's share. The lion's share is obviously the lion, the man, you understand? It's not the lioness, but who hunted, who created that lion's share? for the lion to take that, the male lion to take that great portion. So, you know, a lot of our culture who have these strong male images, they don't have equally strong female images. And that's the problem. It's not that they're not strong females. It's not that strong females are on the other side of sexuality. It's that strong females aren't mentioned by these cowardice males. Sorry if I offend some, right? By the cowardice action that's been taught to so-called modern males, to act macho, which is really to act unbalanced. It's like you're so tense, and if you know that brittle things break, so all that tension is going to make a man act not just a fool, but act violent, might lock him, cause himself to be locked away, you know, cause somebody else to be hurt. So in a lot of senses, we see that the unbalanced male is like that lion who is taking that greater portion and he didn't earn it, you understand? So for all the females who are feeling disempowered by such strong male figures, it's not that you should necessarily go and masculinize yourself. It's actually that you should realize, just like Brother Don said, of the feminine. With the right word, you can take that Goliath down, because he's only puffed up because you're letting him be that steamy and act all ego. So part of a woman's job as being a woman, a wife, is to calm that tense egomaniac too, right? Because sometimes he thinks, you know, he's got everything under control. And she knows where that valve is. That's the extra steam valve to press that button so he can blow off. Except sometimes a lot of these men who are so egocentric, they have no women around them.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? All they have is just these masculine women. It's tantamount to men again. You understand? So it's like he doesn't know what a gentle feminine touch is, because she's so puffed up, she's so aggressive, she's going so hard for her career, she's going so hard to for equality. She's not seeing that equality is not being the same. Equality is being the best of who she is and engendering in him the man to be the best of who he is, right? To get past these ugly male and female gender images that's making it so toxic in our relationships, messing up our families and our communities, you know? I mean, ladies, my word to you is that, I mean, people have always said that there's more required of a woman than a man. Just realize what is required, and it will narrow the searching down. If you can look at your men as principles, then don't settle until you find a principle. But first, you have to have the right principles too. Isn't that the way to go?
Right.
But if you don't have the right principles, you won't be able to find it.
True. William, any take on these matters? Williams?
Yes, sir.
Any take on these
definitely
matters?
Definitely what he said about, we've talked in the past, and one of the things that always sticks out is who you want to attract, you must you must also, well, we attract whoever, what we are. So if you want a certain type of mate, you definitely have to embody those qualities and those traits, and that individual will be attracted to you as well. And I've also noticed that in regards to the Rastafaris, they say something, each one teach one, each one reach one. And I see that in order to make a difference in the world, you have to first make a difference in yourself. And that I would assume that it's the same thing in a relationship. If you want that other person to have certain things, certain qualities, you must change yourself as well. And they will see that, okay, this person is, or my mate is living in a certain way and he's receiving these benefits, and maybe I can try to do the same. So it's definitely first changing yourself, wanting to change yourself, and then it could potentially reciprocate to that other person.
Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Turning to chapter 31 of Proverbs. And again, the verses, the few verses we'll be sharing today, gentlemen, and blessed souls out there, we see that the woman is portrayed here as an industrious business entrepreneur, not someone who is, carrying the shoes and the pipe and the bathrobe of the husband. You know, they can sit down and watch 7 hours of NFL football, you know, on a Sunday afternoon. So in chapter 31, verse 12, King Solomon, again, this I want to remind everyone that the inspiration for Proverbs from the oral Torah tradition of Israel is that he wrote this in tribute of his mother, Bathsheba, who was one of David's wives. And verse 12 reads, "She requites him with good and not with evil all the days of her life." And one example I can give of that right off the bat, simply stating, is that if they are in that type of harmonious relationship that they eventually can fulfill the divine imperative to be fruitful and multiply, that the fact that she has taken upon herself literally the oak of female stewardship at that level of human experience of bearing a child after 9 months of pregnancy, that is a 24/7. There's no break. There's no timeout. There's no halftime. Whatever the terms are in athletics. But this is the ultimate athlete, to be able to bear. I mean, ask an athlete to play 9 months of their sport, you're sure they're going to go down with an injury. But yet a woman is able to bear 9 months, give a week more, a week less, whatever the scenario may be, and out comes a healthy human baby boy or baby girl, baby boy. And no matter what the husband can do, there's as dedicated as a husband can be, there's not once and twice I know that a husband is so dedicated at a level of 24/7. And therefore, even if he did something wrong to her, she doesn't go back. Again, this is a woman of high consciousness, that she can be encouraged to know that she has this power to look beyond the Latin, and but of course not in an abusive relationship, but the husband makes a mistake. And she might make a mistake, but still, when we tally up the level of mistakes in the relationship between man and woman, husband and wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, I mean, some people don't necessarily get married, but they have children, still, there is nothing which equates in terms of goodness of the woman that she can go 9 months, 24/7, bearing a child from initial conception to those wonderful moments of bringing a new child into the world. And as a father of three children, I can just tell you, gentlemen, and blessed souls out there, I'm sure many of you have experienced this and can testify along with me, the first time you see your child in the world, you feel the presence of the Most High with the new creation of your baby daughter or baby son. Jerome Sage?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for the first few weeks around, I would say child's birth, right? The conception part sometimes isn't necessarily met with a lot of celebration, but obviously the part of child's birth, you know, when that newborn comes into the world for real. A lot of men do feel like, you know, they have done something godly, something more amazing than their jobs or anything they could have done with their hands or any ingenious athlete they could have come up with to their minds. For a brief while, for some, it lasts longer. But for a brief while, for all, it seems like that. And especially if they were the kind of man who would have been there with the woman during her pregnancy, you know what I mean? some man is there for the conceiving, but he ain't there for the growing and nurturing stages, right? And sometimes he pass work up near that childbirth time too. Yeah, and I know this is based upon the moods of human life, and so we don't judge based upon what we think is ideal. We're just saying that it is truly an awesome experience for a lot of men. And for a moment there, a lot of them do realize, for real, that life in that sense is greater than anything that they have made. And that their wife, their woman, their baby mother, as we say it in Jamaica, their girlfriends, right, really have done a great godly act. They know it as a man, well, we can't do, right? And even though we had a part in it, we see that the fact that she carried for 9 months that offspring, that has to show you that the greater part of nurturing, growing, has been in her. So you're getting back a part of what is going to be your future, is piece of her. And I say this every time, flesh of her flesh, blood of her blood. You understand? And I know a lot of people don't like to hear that because they are so masculinized, that term, but I don't care. You understand? Because I don't see how else can it be proven in nature that it must be her flesh and it must be her blood. You understand? Because how else are you born? Where does the flesh come from? Where does the blood come from? The seed of life comes from the man. And no one can deny that. The seed of life doesn't come from the woman. It comes from the man, right? But when that seed goes into the woman, that's that spirit, that energy, the flesh that it becomes is her flesh, and the blood is her blood. So the flesh of her flesh and blood of her blood, that's the offspring of life. So in that moment, you realize that a great divine act has occurred. So if man could take that love they have for their baby mother, their wife, their girlfriend, in that moment, and carry it forward into life, it would be more of a fulfilling life if they could remember that. But then the work, world, and the so-called burdens of upbringing of that child overtakes the love of the experience, you know. Sometimes they do it a couple of times, but each time it fades, you know. So give thanks for the true families who through thick and thin. Because in Jamaica, we say through thick and thin. The true families through good times and bad times that have kept together.
Yes.
And learned together, live together, love together, praise the Lord together, give honor and glory together. I give salute.
Beautiful. Williams, any take on these matters? Williams, sir? I know he's still on the line. Oh, he's on. Maybe he put us on hold. Okay, so let's go further. In verse 13, again, the woman, as portrayed by King Solomon, is entrepreneurial. She seeks wool and flax, and she works it with the will of her hand. So from an interdimensional perspective that we have from the world of Chassidut, wool is coming from the sheep, the animal kingdom. And flax, of course, is coming from the vegetative kingdom. The wool of the animal, which came from the vitality of the animal, which manifested to grow hair or wool or whatever you want to call it, the body hair of the sheep or the goat, whatever she may be seeking, and the vegetative matter of the flax, representing all vegetative matter, is the level of vitality and emotional capacity. So the woman works with, as allegorically alluding to this, she works with the vitality of herself and her emotions, because she works it with the will of her hands, which are coming from the will of her heart and the will of her mind. So we see the woman is industrious by her very nature, that she'll take, just as she takes the seed of the man, develops into a full-born child after 9 months, she works with vegetative and animal matter according to her access to these two elements, and she integrates it within the will of her hands, meaning what is her heart-based wisdom, her mind-based wisdom, and she creates something greater than just her emotional capacities and the vitality that she exudes out as a living, breathing, take on these matters, Jerome.
Absolutely. I mean, for a lot of times do we hear about women, my parents would tell me, my mother would tell me about, well, the intuition of woman, but not just that the intuition is just a matter of just having this foresight, but that this foresight creates, she actualizes it, right? She uses this intuition to direct choices, the director actions, right? So, like working with, like as you said, the vegetative and the animal, right, and the flora and the fauna, right, and the industrious nature of a woman. I'm saying that a lot of that industrious nature, to me, has been understood as intuitive. That a woman somehow doesn't just use this didactic knowledge of left brain thinking that I think has been propagated and popularized by the masculine thinking, right? I think she got this kind of right brain emotional kind of feeling, you know, creative centric thoughts, right? And I think that intuition, to me, has been her success in industry. And I think it's good that it came to this point, because maybe some of my arguments, sometimes I don't term them appropriately. But what I'm trying to say is that I think sometimes a lot of the industrialized women are a little bit off kilter, because the true woman of industriousness, right, is far more intuitive and emotional and not so left brain and logical thinking, West Point philosophy, MBA style minded, right? And I think what's happening is that sometimes I think when that industrial woman is totally opposite to the industrious mind that Solomon is talking about, then the modern, some of the modern women won't fit into this, because they're not being led purely by the emotional well-being, you know, to intuitively see what's healthy for them, to choose wisely based upon being able to have a simple feeling of knowing of what is going to go right. And if you are doing that for the right causes, then having such a true personality as a woman would make her the most eligible bachelorette in the whole community region. She'd be the most highly sought after princess in waiting. She'd be the greatest debutante of any if she was to cultivate, as you put it, that nature that Solomon refers to, the industrious nature, versus what I term, you know, my word, play, industrial women that are, I'm not being sarcastic, industrial women that are somewhat, I think, produced from this kind of George Orwellian, you know, kind of a industrial society, a kind of, you know, a carbon copy, one cut fits all mentality, right? And this one cut fits all mentality means that there's no originality, there's no subtlety, there's some of the beautiful color that makes a woman say, no, that is different, unique, and everybody's choosing the same thing. So it seems that, you know, the very essence of life is losing a little bit of its energy. And the true woman of spirit, she knows she wouldn't want a drone, a clone, a carbon, would she? She's original. So why would she want that? So towards more original women and original men. Help. Help for all those out there saying, help, help. And they want those industrious women, not the industrial women. And I say to you, right, yes, and you want true, genuine, nurturing man as well too. Not just these egomaniacs that we call man nowadays.
Very beautifully said. And just to embellish one more point, that from the Matsuda David, who was one of the great oral Torah traditional commentators, that the woman is self-motivated. She doesn't have to be coerced into her husband to become industrious. In this case, she doesn't have to be coerced by her husband to purchase and spin it. A woman who knows her purpose, again, not to be a servant to the husband, but a woman by her very nature will be industrious. I like that, not industrial, as you just mentioned. And here now we're even given an exponential analogy of woman, Jerome Sage and Blessed Losing out there in chapter 31, verse 14. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. I mean, wow, you know, when I was growing up, I lived on, you know, in middle-class America, but occasionally I would go visit my grandparents. We'd drive along the west side of Manhattan. There's the Hudson River. You see these big ocean liners and supply ships.
Ooh.
But I imagine, say, like 300-400 years ago, or let's say go back to the time of Solomon, 2,600 years ago, it was an imposing sight. It perked the curiosity of those going to greet the ship at the shore. It represented a certain power. And here we see Solomon is likening a woman to a merchant ship. I mean, this is and this is the power of the woman, whose spiritual powers are able to bring things beyond what would normally be perceived as what was in her grasp. And again, I don't hear this in the language here in America. You know, the woman must be equal, the woman must be this, the man must be this. We're talking about a power within the woman. And before I turn to you, Jerome Sage, that one example of this is that Rachel went through a certain period when she, after she married Jacob, from the patriarch to the matrix of Israel, she felt a certain shame because she didn't bring children. But eventually, how was she likened to the merchant ship Rachel? That her son Joseph, who became the vice of Egypt, would eventually support the whole world like a ship that is full of good foods at the time of the famine, the horrendous famine that took place in ancient Egypt. So woman has this potential. And again, if we just, as you mentioned before, we have to bring this into the discussion. Women, you have this spiritual, cognitive, emotional power to bring from beyond that which is perceivable by the human eye. We have a teaching on our oral Torah tradition, Jerome Sage, that a healthy, good eye can see for about 60 miles. I guess that's, 50, 52 kilometers in the measurements you have down in the West Indies. But here we see that woman has this ability to bring food for thought, food for ingestion, all types of merchandise, if she knows her potential. And we of men promote this ideal to them, not this industrial, though, this industrious ideal that every woman should she, just as they're being swayed into wearing all this type of makeup and lipstick and this and that, they should be encouraged to be able to be like a merchant ship to bring bounty to her family and community.
I would say to use a Catholic matriarch. I mean, cause sometimes you use matriarchs and people say, and judge. I'm not using this to appease. I'm not Catholic, but I'm going to use a Catholic matriarch. I mean, Mother Teresa to us, right? I mean, I'm sure people always have a billion things about the images we use. But I use Mother Teresa because I grew up seeing this woman as a symbol. I didn't look at her as a Catholic, just to be, for those who want to differentiate such thought, because you can look at a Catholic without defining the person as their religious belief. When I looked at Mother Teresa, right, I saw in that woman the possibility that the compassion of a woman could be more than towards her own children, and it could be so strong. I want you to hear me carefully here. It could be so strong, prove a Christ-like principle, that love is the greatest weapon of all, that it really neutralizes all of the other aggressive-based, weaponized thinking, especially in the masculine. I've seen from what images have been located in my consciousness of that woman, that she has been across boundaries created by the egomaniacs through warfare, you understand me, and through depravity to touch the human soul. So if you're saying to me of a woman or a character, within the scope of what I see in multimedia, what I've been grown on, right? I used Florence Nightingale as before, my time as a Jamaican, right? But and Mary Seacole is a Jamaican who's in the history books as being extraordinary women during World War I and World War II. But I use Mother Teresa to say that, to agree with your point, that if we think women are just merely a fashioned opposites to male ego, that is, then we would miss the beauty by talking about equality, equality, equality to fit this industrial ideology. When there are women like Mother Teresa, how are you going to measure her, may I ask? Shall you measure against a woman who was born 50 children? Can you measure deeds against a nation who has passed a policy to preserve a certain kind of an ethnic minority? How do you measure what Mother Teresa has done? How do you measure it? That's an idea, but a manifestation of a woman that fits what you just said to me, of what we're just exposing, for the idea of being that merchant ship. But what she brought wasn't necessarily material wares, but were the wares of the soul. And these things were what was most lacking in a lot of the environments around our lives. And that is a prime example that this great compassionate nature of a woman and this great industrious nature of a woman can come together as medical charities, as these organizations, right, that go across the length and breadth of the earth and try and do succeed in creating some modicums of success in lifestyle, in families, transformation in behavior, in attitude, in ways of living. Because this is where it all gets down to. When our lives become all mechanical, it's hard for us to be free and original and happy. So we have to realize that we cannot, as we say, scientifically analyze and create happiness. It is actually far more unscientific, far more natural, loving, and humane. You know, it's not so, you know, designed, pedantic, as some would say. It's not based upon knowledge or practice of the esteem. You know, it's available to all of us, man and woman. This is what we should strive for, something that is simple, subtle, yet fulfilling, that the manifest man and manifest woman can really begin to enjoy our lives together and the lives of our children. And the things we do with our minds and our bodies are secondary to what we are and how we are, you know?
Beautiful. Drumsage, I'd like to direct the program as we are coming to our conclusion to a prayer that was uttered by a prophetess of Israel. Actually, there were two prayers that she uttered in the book of Samuel, and this is the mother, actually, of Samuel, Hannah. The first prayer, I'm not going to read it, but those who want can go see her prayer in chapter 1, verses 10 and 11 in the book of Samuel 1. In the book of Samuel 1, again, chapter 2, 10 short verses. Again, this merchant ship bringing food from afar, I mean, her prophetic prayer was bringing us spiritual food from way beyond the boundaries of point A to point B. It was from the world, the future world, to this world back then, 2,600-2,700 years ago. Now, going into now, well into the, we're coming up to almost the first fifth of the 21st century. So I'd like to share this prayer and have Jerome Sage give his perspective on it. And this is a prayer that Hannah prayed in chapter 2, verse 1. Hannah prayed to God and said, "My heart exalts in the Almighty. My triumph is from Creator. I can now speak before my enemies, for I rejoice in your salvation. None is as holy as you, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our Creator. Do not drone on with boast. Do not let your not arrogance pass your lips, for the Creator is a God all-knowing. For by him deeds are measured. The bowels of the mighty are broken, but the stumbling are clawed in hidden strength. Those once sated must hire out for bread, but those once hungry may cease their labors. The barren woman bears seven, but the woman with many children is wretched. God takes life and gives life, casts down to the grave and raises up. Creator makes poor and makes rich, humbles and elevates. He raises the poor from the dust, the impoverished from the dung heaps, to seat them with the mighty, apportioning the seats of honor to them. For the foundations of the earth are Creator's, and he sets the countenance on them. He guards the step of his pious ones, but the wicked are caught off in darkness. For a man does not prevail with strength. God's foes are broken. He thunders over them in heaven. Creator judges the earth to its uttermost parts. Grant power to his king and raise the strength of his anointed in triumph." Drum says, this is the mother whose son would anoint King David. So I would say this is almost like what we're going to see eventually in the young David, and as he matured and eventually became king of Israel, a sort of a primordial projection of or it was actual prophecy, a prophetic, it's considered by our sages of Israel, a prophetic prayer. This is the basis upon which that Samuel, after being born of his mother, and by the way, he was a Nazarite, she consecrated him to be a Nazarite even before he was born, and then eventually he took on the role as a Nazarite his entire 52 years of life. He only lived to 52. And then he bequeathed his wisdom to King David, the sweet singer of Israel. So here we see, when I read that prayer, I almost felt like I was reading the Psalms of David. But we see because of her, there would be eventually be the anointing of David. So here we see the merchant ship bringing goods from afar. To this generation, we are positively affected by this righteous woman's prayer. Another type of goods coming from afar. You take on these matters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And at this point, I go to my own mother and say that, you know, I probably shared the story a couple of times. One of the proudest moments in my life, and one of the few proud moments that I built my life upon. Maybe people would say that I'm an informed person or a man of information. But my mother is a woman of information. And without a shadow of a doubt, my gift of information comes from her. The religious part of myself is definitely my father. It definitely comes from my father and my father's side of the family. I would not even flinch on that. That's true. But in terms of the part of intellect, or people would say being a person of word or information, that's my mother, because my mother is one of the honorees, that's one of the smartest persons from my regions here in St. Andrew, where we're from. She was on the honor roll, and I said, looking up at her name on the honor roll in school, in those early stages, was what kept me sane, sound, and on a path. So my mother gave me her, what I would call her library, but in Jamaica we call it her bookcase. I would like to think of it as a library because it did contain several books, right? But the reason why she gave me her library of books was that out of every child, I was already reading the books a lot before I could read all of them. So it was already like basically it was my library. I was interested in her books of equation, of all the work she was doing. So my mother's interest in book, let me bring it down to layman's terms because sometimes people are thinking I'm going too high up. To bring it down to layman's term, my mother's love of books, of information, was why I loved information, because in her room she had this heavy bookcase filled with all these different books of information, right? And also her own books and her childhood days. I still have them to this day, by the way. So it does have an integral part. So a mother is more of a role model than I would say a lot of fathers have become in time and space. Those, they hold the role in terms of the narrative of being the role model of the family, but the nurturing role model, protector of the family, like that mother hen protecting her chicken, is the woman, you know. She really is the protector of her family, and as her wings expand out, symbolizing her loving consciousness and behavior, we would better serve to honor our mothers and our fathers and our day would be longer. So we would be great human beings if we can engender those principles that Grandma and Ma taught us, to see that our daughters will be this way and that our wives also will be informed from that in terms of the principles. Like you said, that she has taught unto her son that will become the ways that he would actualize, that others would know him for. So when you meet a good husband, ladies, you can see his mother in him. Isn't that what they usually say, right? Is that old wives say that is a fact, right? And vice versa. So I would say that for a husband looking for his wife, that, you know, if you recognize in being a good father, you've done a great job, then you have undoubtedly, you know, educated a great wife for a great husband, you know. So blessings to all who are great parents, who are on the struggles each day and all different socio-economical configurations. You know, continue, because you are Anna, and you are like my mother. You are Rachel. You are the beautiful Nikki. You are all who have been living, nurturing, protecting your children, teaching them, showing them by example. And you are doing a wonderful job. So blessings to you, Nikki. You're doing an awesome job. And love and thank you for your support and understanding. Respect to you.
Beautiful. Thank you, Drum Sage. I think at this point we're going to wind down the program. I just, first, before I formally thank Drum Sage for coming on today, I want to mention to bless those listening out there, whether you're listening to us live or ultimately in the archive version, that, again, I've been in production here for about 8.5 years now, and I've been told by my mentors not to stop. However, I really wish to exponentially develop the platform that we are currently working with, whether to be broadcasting on a more advanced level of blog talk radio. But the truth is, I'm a little bit more ambitious than that. Someone like Jerome Sage, he's in Jamaica, I'm in Brooklyn, for whatever reasons, you know, the day-to-day grind, I still am not yet ready to go to Jamaica. He's not, for whatever reason, he's very busy in Jamaica. He's not able to come to Brooklyn yet or to New York City. With someone like Drum Sage, I need to make a... I'm sure Drum Sage would agree to this. We need to make a documentary, not just a radio show. But in order to do that, we're asking people from around the world to partner with us. And you can go to www.paypal.me/Don, D-O-N-Z-U-S-Y-A, Goodman, G-O-O-D-M-A-N. And if we were to get a surplus, not only would we develop the platform Blog Talk Radio, but it's also to make award-winning documentary, Drum Sage. Drum Sage is involved in acts of kindness, and over the summer, he made a couple of videos about the difficulties, just the sheer logistical nightmares, procuring a wheelchair for someone who needed such services, such a device, in order to have a greater sense of freedom. So this is what we're proposing, listeners, is that you don't have to break your bank account. Since we've had hundreds of thousands of listeners the last 8.5 years, any of you who have listened to the show, $1, $5, $10, $15, $18, and also you can even write, you'd like myself to make a dedication. You can also, I can pass along the dedication to Jerome Sage. He can make his prayers in Jamaica. So in two points in the world, you can have someone praying for you or publicly acknowledging your kindness to partner with us. And again, that's www.paypal.me/DonZosia Goodman. And hopefully we're going to get a good outcome, because, you know, sometimes I've joked, Jerome Sage, with some of my former co-hosts, that they might think I'm a computer-generated image. I've met two of my former, one, unfortunately, Joseph Israel passed on, but Dennis Ryan is still, thank God, he's still alive. So he's come to one of my family celebrations when my son became a man at the age of 13. So I know you know I'm not a CGI, and I know you're not a CGI, but the point is, the more that we communicate, Jerome Sage and I, and with other hosts that I have, I really believe, as the Rebbe said, we can get behind those closed doors of the human heart, which is unfortunately is still inundated with matters that prompt individuals like Jerome Sage and myself to say, we're not telling you what to do. We're considering you to consider your options to actualize your potential as a human steward upon the face of the earth. And I'll allow Jerome Sage, please make your concluding statement for today's humble effort.
Oh, blessings, Brother Don. Absolutely. I mean, we know the context of how it is that, you know, the world structure design, you know, especially when you want to be fortuitous in a program or in something that, but one would consider of a very charitable nature, right? So when you have a program that is not necessarily for the commercial book, then the voluntary contributory dollar is what really goes a far way. But I go further to say that dollar to contributed in love is of a far more greater essence, because being a follower of Christ, I would use Christian principles and ideology. And the one I would use is the one where Christ said, the lady that put in her 2 cents put in more than others. So, and I think the difference was it was all she had. And I think if how we assess that was, where was her life and all the needs that she had? And that 2 mites could not have even satisfied her needs, but she gave it, meaning that she really did give all that she had. So if we give with that true spirit of love, even a $5, a $10, you understand me, or even a good word, a good thought, a prayer, pray for us, pray for the ability for us to do this, pray for Amen. That, you know, the network and the systems that we work on, that they themselves in turn might also become charitable and allow for more time in certain regards, allow it for us to be able to do this even a better way. I mean, Trail Life Television Networks on YouTube, I give thanks for the 1 or 2 persons who have, you know, contributed and who have kept me going forward to doing these videos, and even for those who were supporting during the times of Steeler Media as well too. Because, like Don says, it's not very easy to do this, especially because remember the essence of our society is remuneration and profitability. So if you're doing something and it's not necessarily turning a profit, you don't necessarily attract investors. You don't necessarily attract those who are commercially looking for a profit. So obviously, you know, this is non-eugenics, but this is non-profit as well. So if you want to make some greater value, then there needs to be something and a means by which we can do that in a more amicable and loving way. And I think for those who contribute, you know, that's the best way so far, until we can create maybe services and products that are built from this. A documentary would be a great way to carry forward the works that we're doing. It will be a meeting of the 2 living souls and all those who are around us or who can make it into such a moment, and show that, you know, really bridging gaps, you know. Like you said, Rebbe says going beyond the blockages of the heart and the body and the mind, that those radio waves are opening up those hidden portals of our fears, you know, of our rejections, of our conformities, to be free, to be happy, to be strong enough to actualize our actual self. Male and female, he created us.
Amen. In his image, or in creator's
image.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay, Blissos, we're gonna end today's program. We're gonna segue out of today's program with a band that originally from Israel. I think they're out in L.A. now. In fact, it was the last band that our mutual friend Joseph Israel, blessed memory, we're almost a year since, unfortunately, we lost this delightful soul who, for only John knows why he had to go upstairs, but yet he did. But he played with this band on their album from last year. They're called the Moshav Band, which literally means a place of settlement. And this song is called Return Again, which I played before, which is the whole idea of returning to the land, not just to your physical land, not just to your soul, but the land of your soul, meaning the place where your soul has an abode, is a place that we can actually access more pleasantly, more peacefully, if we seek to go back. As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, more and more people around the world are looking for their ancestral roots, and our ultimate ancestral roots is the abode of our souls. So this song discusses this matter, and may all matters that Jerome Sage and I have talked about continue to manifest on our next month's broadcast with the blessings of the Most High in the way of Ahava Chad, one love, Goral Chad, one destiny, Kolan of all of us, Badarchim and Darki Shom, in a pleasant, peaceful way. And I have to remind myself, I remind Jerome Sage, but myself before anyone else, and all of you blessed souls, I've got to be good. We've all got to be good. It's a teva tov, lehetiv, it's a nature to do good. Creator, who is the source of all mercies and goodness, patiently waits us to activate that human spirit, which is anti-eugenic and non-for-profit and has a disdain for hatred and for jealousy and is not in need to compete with anyone else except to be in the competition of bettering ourselves to the exclusion of making another person feel like we're putting them down. We can do it. It's a fabric of this creation because it's an eternal teaching from the ancients to this day. Let's go on now with the Moshav Band. Return again. Take care, everyone. I'm